Sandra, first of all, can you tell me just a little bit more about your role at Duncan Baird Publishers and what your key responsibilities are there?
Yes, I started at Duncan Baird just in February, actually, this year. And Duncan Baird was, I guess, best known as an illustrated publisher and had produced books in quite a wide range of subject areas, sort of general reference and cookery and gardening and health. And as a publishing house, it had a particular interest in mind, body and spirit. So I was asked to commission illustrated books in that area, and illustrated books tend to focus not just on the UK market, but also the US and European markets as well. And we have co-edition publishers there, and we translate books, so they work in those markets. But I think partly as a reflection of the sign of the times, I was also asked to commission non-illustrated books. Duncan Baird has another imprint, Watkins, which has, I guess, also focused quite strongly on mind, body and spirit and self-help and personal development. And because in the current market, illustrated books are extremely expensive to produce, and there are lots of issues with things like paper prices increasing dramatically, all the costs are going up. In that kind of scenario, a non-illustrated book is a little bit more economic to produce. So I cover both areas, which is great, and I receive proposals from agents and also direct from authors, but I also, largely on the illustrated side, I suppose, I also come up with concepts for books myself, and then I would find an author to write it. And then once the manuscript comes in, I work with the author, giving some advice on the structure of the book as a whole. So perhaps a chapter needs amplifying or rearranging, that kind of thing. And I oversee the production of the book in-house. I prepare budgets for books, I do the contracts. It's actually quite hands-on because Duncan Baird is quite a small company, so I do lots of administrative work, which isn't quite so exciting to talk about, but it's an important part of the role as well.
I'm interested to hear the fact that you actually work with the author on the structure of the book as well, because we hear so much about the demise of the editor, idea that writers are very much on their own, and if the book's not perfect, then it's not going to go through. Do you think that's specific to the kind of genre of books that you're working in?
Partly, and I think because we are a smaller publisher, every book really counts for us. We have to work quite hard at making sure each book is the best it can possibly be, because we don't necessarily have the large turnover of titles that a larger publisher would have. So I think it's partly a matter of the size of the publishing house. And yes, I think the subject area is important, because in mind, body and spirit and personal development, you are, you know, speaking quite directly to the reader. I think there's quite an intimate relationship with the reader, and I think it's really important to get both the structure of the book right and the voice right as well.
Yeah. I mean, we hear so much as well about publishing today and, for example, how difficult it can be for new authors to break through. Do you think the current economic climate is going to affect new authors in your area?
Yes, I mean, I think you have to be realistic that every book now is under a great deal of scrutiny. Every proposal really gets examined in detail, because it's got to justify its presence on the list. And it is quite a demanding process of, you know, the book has to offer obviously something special and have to have its unique selling points, as we say. That's a kind of big marketing thing, what makes the book stand out in the crowd. And obviously the author and an author with a track record or some kind of public profile just helps, you know, it all helps get publicity and get attention and make the book easier to get into bookshops and to get attention when it's out there. So it is hard. But having said that, I think publishers are still looking for really strong titles. And I think because what's unfortunate is that, you know, people are very cautious and are looking at, you know, what has sold in the past and trying to use that as a guide as to what to publish. But that ends up in a vicious cycle that, you know, I think publishers also recognise you have to break free. You have to be open to new ideas and new voices. So I don't want to sound too discouraging, because I think good, strong ideas and good writers will always have a place, definitely. Mm-hmm.
You know, I talk a lot with my clients and with members of the Completion Club as well about this whole thing about the public profile, and we've got some members in the club who are, you know, very much out there with their websites and newsletters, and, you know, one's had a recent TV appearance. So I think there is certainly a growing awareness amongst authors of that as well, I think. But, you know, thinking about that, when an author, you know, I'm going to sort of start, I suppose, from the new author's perspective, because I think so many people listening to this interview will be in that position. For example, what are some of the areas that you are, you know, really interested in commissioning at the moment, for example, or that you see as being really zeitgeisty?
Well, I certainly think that personal development is a really strong area. I mean, it always has been. It's always been a good area to publish in. But I think people are facing so many challenges now. You know, if you sort of are paying attention to the news and you just realise that we're in for a tough time, people are going to be under pressure, you know, in terms of their finances, in terms of their careers. That's going to put extra pressure on relationships. So I think we already sadly know that, you know, people are getting anxious, more anxious and more depressed than they've ever been before. You know, it's a horrible statistic, but it's certainly a fact that the incidence of depression and anxiety is going up. And I think a book, as I said before, can break through it. You can have a very personal relationship with a book, which I think is very appealing when people are looking for answers or inspiration or direction in their life. And when you consider a book is still actually, you know, very good value actually for the amount of information and the fact that you can be reading it and rereading it and, you know, having an ongoing relationship with a really great book, it's actually very, very good value, and people are not necessarily going to want to go to a counsellor or you know, not in a position to do that, but are still going to be looking for answers. And I think obviously that's something where, you know, you would be wanting a background in psychology or in counselling, but I think it's a really important area. I think the other area that has struck me is just looking at the books, perhaps the surprising books that have done well. Books about nature, but written in that sort of narrative non-fiction style. So I'm thinking of something like The Wild Places by Robert McFarlane or Beachcombings. They've done actually really very well when you look at sales figures of books, which obviously we do all the time. We can tap into that. And it's really interesting that people are, I think, increasingly interested in a connection with the natural world, perhaps when we tend to be living quite an urban lifestyle now, I think, and we're anxious and concerned about what's happening in the environment. And I think a beautifully written book that helps us kind of come to terms with nature and explores that is a really strong kind of subject.
Mm. I mean, when you receive, you know, a book or a proposal through from an agent, say, or a publisher, presumably, you know, if it falls into one of these categories and is very well done, it's going to attract your attention. What kind of thing is it that when you open a proposal or a book makes you excited?
I think with proposals, one of the strongest things is the title, actually. It's exactly the same thing, you know, if you think of a book's path all the way through from when it catches an editor's eye, we then pitch it to sales and marketing, they then pitch it to a bookseller, the bookseller gets it on the stand. And a really great title is so important, and I think especially in nonfiction, if you can't come up with a good title, it suggests that you haven't really focused what you want to say. You haven't got a clear enough idea of what this book really is about, because a bad title confuses people, or it reaches the wrong audience, or doesn't reach an audience at all. So I think a great title, you know, gets you a long way before you've even read anything further. Mm-hmm. So that's a really important start, and I think for any writer, it's worth really spending a lot of time on it and brainstorming and testing things out with friends and colleagues, because it can make a huge difference. Then in a proposal, I have to say it's always really refreshing in nonfiction that someone has done their market research and can really tell you, these are the other books that are out there that are covering a similar kind of subject, but this is what makes my book special and different. And that just shows that the author has really thought about it, has gone out there and understands that particular book has to justify its place. It has to compete against many, many others out there. And that really kind of makes me feel, yes, this is serious. The person's really done their homework and, you know, knows that they're offering something that is really different and special.
I think what's interesting for me when I hear you speak is I'm almost hearing this sense, because I'm hearing this sense of excitement from you, that actually, on the one hand, you have got this situation where, you know, we hear it time and time again that sales and marketing are in charge, and it's very much about money and profits. But on the other hand, I think I'm hearing you saying that actually, if it excites you, if it's got something slightly different about it, then possibly there's a reason why some books are more profitable, because they're more exciting in some way. Is that fair?
Yes, I think that absolutely is fair. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of publishing that takes place, obviously, and there are some books that very much trade on their profile of the author, and they kind of fall into a certain type of publishing, and there are other books that, you know, meet an immediate reference need that, you know, there isn't a book like that out there. But then there are other books that just capture your imagination because they are really original, and it's a book of ideas that is exciting, and it, you know, that's still true. That absolutely is still true in publishing houses, that, you know, we are excited by original work and, you know, want to publish something that's different and special, because, you know, publishing is full of the stories of the great books that have, you know, just stood out from the crowd and been different and, you know, captured people's imagination.
Mm. Can you think of an example of something like that, as an editor, where something just kind of leapt out at you and that you took that through and it turned into something that you are really proud of?
Yes, I think there was a book that was actually written by an academic. It was called An Unnatural History of the Sea, and this was published in my previous job at Octopus Publishing. And it could have been, as an academic, he could have written quite a dry tome on the problem with overfishing. But in fact, he took a really imaginative approach, and he didn't want to sort of depress people or, you know, bore them. Quite the opposite. He wanted to capture people's imagination. And so he took, you know, a great narrative approach to this subject, and it was absolutely fascinating right from the start, reading about fishing, you know, the first commercial fishing, which happened in freshwater ponds in the Middle Ages, and the tapping into rivers at that time, and he had great stories from original research, and that isn't what you'd necessarily expect a writer with his background to do, but he took an original approach, and we got really good reviews for that book, and you know, and it was recognised as an important subject, but treated in a really imaginative way.
It sounds as if the kind of the bringing in the kind of narrative element really, really helped there. Is that something that particularly attracts you in general, do you think?
Or does
it
Yes.
Obviously, it depends on the kind of book. But
it does depend on the kind of book, but it is a way to explore some subjects in a really refreshing kind of way. So I think you know, these days as well, book publishing is under pressure from all sorts of other kinds of media. So you have to, I think, go back to what is special about the reading process, you know, that process of involving your reader and developing a strong relationship. And strong narrative is a really important way to do that. And I think that's something that if you're looking at the other media that we're competing against, if you're looking at the internet or magazines or television, DVD, books still do offer that opportunity to have, you know, quite a long relationship with words on the page over, you know, a number of maybe weeks even, you know, depending on the length of the book. And I think that is special, and it's something worth bearing in mind about what's important about the nature of the book. And, you know, we might be facing challenges from electronic media, but there is something about the good long read that, you know, it's really satisfying, and the book is still a really good form of media for.
Mm. How do you see new technology beginning to impact at Duncan Baird? Is it an area that you're thinking of expanding into, or are you sticking with the good old fashioned the good old fashioned book? I shouldn't say that, but the wonderful everlasting book.
Yes, I mean, it's a really challenging time. There's no doubt about that, and I think all publishers are just, you know, exploring where this is all going to go and what are we doing. I mean, I think because we publish illustrated books and we have quite high production values for those books, so, you know, we have some very beautiful full colour, beautifully illustrated books that are, you know, a thing of beauty in their own right. And I think the book as a beautiful object that gives you further information is going to continue. So I think there is still a place for that. We are thinking of all sorts of other applications, and we have included or have started to include CDs, and we're looking at memory sticks or a form of a kind of memory stick that could download information or provide hot links to websites. So we're thinking about all this, but very much trying to keep coming back to, is it complementary? Does it actually offer the reader what they really need to get the most out of this information? I think in self-help, audio CDs have become increasingly popular, and that, you know, media works really well for things like meditation and visualization. It's very helpful to have someone talking you through it. So that, I think, makes a lot of sense. But we're very much still, you know, exploring the options, and it'll be interesting to see how things bed down. I think, you know, it's a bit like when TV came in and radio was sort of having to, you know, see where it went and what it could offer that TV couldn't. And it's going to be similar here, I think.
Do you have a kind of a sense of how publishing might change over the next 10 years? If you had a bit of a crystal ball and you could look into the future, do you have the same 10 years' time?
Yeah. Well, I think we probably are going to see more self-publishing. I think if you look at what's happening now, you know, the technology is out there for people to get their work online. So what could happen is that there is more online publishing and networking, so that that's how people find out about something great to read is through networks. And it's going to be really interesting. I mean, I think, on the other hand, the fact that, you know, reading groups are incredibly popular and writing groups are incredibly popular shows that, you know, people are looking for the book still, or the information in the book in some way. So I think we have to kind of bear in mind that that relationship, you know, with the page, even if it is an electronic page, is still, you know, quite a profound one. And I don't think it's going to disappear. I think that, you know, books have a life. Whether, you know, certain kinds of big, heavy reference material ends up being delivered electronically because it just, you know, makes more sense. That probably, you know, is a way that certain kinds of educational publishing will go, and I think is already going down that route. And if you're looking at perhaps cookbooks or reference books that people might want to access, again, via their computer. But it's interesting because, you know, cookbooks are actually still selling incredibly well. So I think people are still finding that that presentation, you know, accessible and something pleasing about turning a page. So perhaps the you know, that isn't going to just die out. I'm, as you can probably hear, I don't know where the future lies, and it's certainly a time of transition. So I think publishers just have to be really flexible and certainly look at, you know, electronic forms of delivery as being really important, but not losing sight of, you know, the book as a physical object, I think is really important. And as I said, that long relationship that the reader has with the words on the page, I don't see that dying out.
No. Interesting enough, as you were speaking, I was thinking it's funny because this afternoon I bought a book sort of on an impulse that was called The Sensual Home, and it had a beautiful sort of grey velvet cover. And it was suede or something, but it was actually the beauty of the object. And I'd also had this on a reading list from the past. I'd seen it before and noted it. So it was a kind of a combination of factors that led to buying it in that moment. Yes. But it is that sort of what makes a reader decide to buy a book at a particular moment. I think you're right. I think just that very kind of sensual thing is part of it. They're having the object in it.
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's going to be interesting because I guess a younger generation is now coming along who, you know, have been growing up with computers and have a different relationship with electronic media, you know, to people even of my generation, you know, where books were still the main source of information up until, you know, the last sort of 15, 10 years, I suppose. So it'll be interesting, you know, what happens with the population sort of change. But I remain hopeful. You know, I think that people are still reading stories to their children. They're still kind of encouraging their child to have a relationship with books from an early age as well. So I am actually quite hopeful that there's something magical there that, you know, just doesn't disappear with the change in technology.
Yeah, yeah. I want to come back for a moment to this whole area of the first-time author. One of my clients who may be on the line tonight sent me an email talking about the demise of the first-time unknown author cultivation in mainstream publishing. It seems to her that publishers used to seek and support new writers, but part of the process has disappeared or lessened, leaving both vacuums and opportunities. How do you respond to that? Do you think there is truth in that, that publishers are not nurturing first-time authors the way they used to?
I mean, I'm sure that's true. I think that certainly in the, you know, the larger publishing houses I've worked in, I have noticed that over the period of time I've been in publishing, and it's you know, must be 20 years now, there are just fewer editors than there used to be, and, you know, fewer editors managing more books. So there's less time to really work with an author, and the luxury of, you know, working at your desk in-house on, you know, one title, it just doesn't really happen anymore, sadly. So so to that extent, I think it's probably true. But I don't know, equally I think, you know, publishers are aware of wanting to have great new ideas, great exciting new books, and you can't just rely on your old stable of authors. You need to be looking for new talented writers. So it is more difficult, because obviously an author with a track record is just easier to get, perhaps the support from bookshops at that first level. You know, increasingly booksellers are looking at sales records and analysing, you know, the likelihood of a book selling, and obviously if they've got a writer, an experienced writer on board, they can do that analysis. But I think, you know, great writers, you know, still have chances to get published, absolutely. I think it just means that probably writers are relying perhaps more on agents than they used to in the past to give that kind of guidance and direction, and that you can't necessarily expect that an editor will do that in-house anymore. So I think it probably puts more pressure on first-time writers to, you know, be as good as they can be before the manuscript starts getting onto editors' desks.
Mm. I've sometimes heard that non-fiction authors, for example, sort of authors writing personal development or business books, for example, don't need a literary agent as much as fiction authors, for example. It's easier to approach a non-fiction publisher if you're a first-time author. Do you find that more material is coming to you direct from newer authors, or would you advise a first-time author in, for example, personal development to still try to find a literary agent?
I think that first-time authors in that area can do a lot themselves, actually. You know, I think if you're writing in personal development or business books, you know, the books out there on the market are a really good guide to the sorts of ways you should be structuring your book and the sort of language you should be using. And you can do that research yourself without having to rely on an agent for it. Obviously, in certain kinds of nonfiction, the profile of the author, as in, you know, you are an expert in that field, goes a very long way. And, you know, that's how we would be promoting you with sales and marketing, and how they would in turn sell it to booksellers, is this is a leading expert in this field. So if you do have a profile like that, or, you know, you're able to show what you're already doing via websites or your own networking, or just building yourself a profile and an identity, is something, again, you don't need an agent to do that. You know, the more you can do yourself to network, to get a profile out there, the better. And you can present all that to a publisher in a really good proposal that outlines your expertise, your background, you know, the evidence that shows what you have done in this field. And again, you know, I think agents, the advantage of agents is that you are more likely to get attention, certainly, and you're more likely to be read by editors. But a really good proposal, you know, well presented and professionally presented, also does get read. Well, it certainly does in our publishing house.
Yeah, yeah.
So nothing gets rejected without being looked at by someone. And, you know, you can tell very quickly what's a professional proposal and what isn't. So I, you know, I really would strongly recommend all authors to pay a lot of attention to their initial covering letter and then the proposal itself, and make that as absolutely professional as it can be.
Yeah. Having said that, regarding agents, are there any agents that you have a particularly good relationship with that particularly specialise in your area?
Susan Mears is very good in the spirituality and spiritual development field and self-help, and she is very enthusiastic, you know, very very much focused on that subject area. It's a personal interest of hers, and she used to work as an editor with Element Publishers before they were bought by HarperCollins. So she very much is in tune with what happens in publishing houses as well. So I certainly think she's great. She always has new authors as well. Having said that, you know, she may be deluged now, but she has a genuine, real interest in the subject area, and that is so important. And, you know, agents will kind of vary in their enthusiasm for subject areas. So in the mind, body and spirit field, she probably really does stand out as someone who's remained really focused on it, and you know, has been for, you know, a good 15 years now, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are other agents as well. I have to say, some I know are not taking on new clients right now, so I'm not going to mention their names. But I think you can, you know, from the writers and editors of the yearbook, you do get quite a good brief description of the subject areas that agents are interested in, and it's certainly worth really studying that and not sending proposals to agents who don't list your subject area, because, you know, you don't want to make things harder for yourself.
Yeah.
It's definitely best to target agents who are clearly saying this is the kind of thing they're looking for.
Thank you. And lastly, I just want to touch upon the fact that I know you've also written fiction yourself in the past, and you were actually shortlisted for the Daily Mail novel writing competition in 2007. I wonder whether you're still finding time for writing fiction now, or whether that's an area that still interests you personally.
Well, it does, very much so, and I do try to find time. I'm sure, like everyone, it's really hard to make time in the week for it, and so I'm sure not alone at all in saying I'd love to have more time, and it's hard to do. But yeah, I'm very much interested in writing, and I am working on a second novel. So it's just the business of being disciplined, I think, and you know, it's true what they say. You just have to make time regularly in your weekly schedule, and just because it just simply will not happen otherwise. So, so yes, I'm doing my best, and it's a slow process, but I'm still working away.
Does that sort of affect you as an editor, do you think, the fact that you've seen the two sides of publishing, sort of trying to break through as a fiction writer, but also being in a position of power, actually, you know, as an editor in a publishing house? Does that affect your commissioning in any way, for example, or just your attitude to writers?
I think it's probably just as well I commission non-fiction, because I think it would be really hard to be commissioning fiction and trying to write it. I think the demarcation would be difficult. So I think it certainly gives me a great sympathy for the hard work that writers put into their work, and a great deal of sympathy and you know, admiration for anyone who manages to get their project complete. You know, that is a great achievement, and I do really appreciate proposals where people are submitting, you know, three chapters. They're serious enough, whether it's you know, a non-fiction business book or whatever the subject might be, they've not just had the idea and they've got a contents list, but they've been bothered to really, you know, perfect the approach, the style and the approach over, you know, a good three chapters. That's, and it's surprising that a lot of people don't do that. But when people do, I really, you know, acknowledge that they want to make the writing itself the best it can be. So I think, I think I do have more sympathy for the the writer's task and I guess a sense of, you know, the time that's needed as well, that, you know, a book is a major production, so you need to be serious about it and you need to set aside time to do it. Maybe a bit of envy when I get a manuscript submitted and they've actually written the whole thing. I think, well done, you know, and wish I was in the same position. So,
complete it is a big step, isn't it?
It is.
To take it through to the end, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I think the final question I want to ask you really is one which has come up when I ask members of the group to put questions to you. A word that came up for several people was the word risk. Somebody asked if publishers ever take a risk on a less commercial book, or what's the biggest risk you've ever taken on a book? How is risk seen in publishing these days?
Yes, I mean, again, different publishers have a different sense of risk. Different houses are... It's quite interesting, you know, there are different cultures in different houses, very much so, and some publishers I've worked for were very risk averse, and actually, you know, I would say possibly suffered for that because it simply meant they weren't getting enough interesting new titles out there, and it started to show. I mean, there's always a bit of a time lag with any publishing list, obviously, that it takes time for a proposal to come to us. It may not be completed, so we have to wait for the author to write it, and then it goes into the production process. So there's always a bit of a time lag, but you do very much notice in some publishing houses when the culture has changed and suddenly what was quite an exciting list has become quite dull. So, you know, in the current climate, yes, it's tough and yes, everyone is being very cautious and looking for, you know, all the ways in which this book can get an extra chance. So, you know, looking increasingly at what the author themselves can do, whether they have developed a strong network, what kind of promotion they're interested in doing or could do, or good contacts they have. All those things really, really just add to the whole package, which just strengthens it. But other publishers, and I would certainly put Duncan Baird amongst them, are really interested in creative ideas, and perhaps because we are a smaller publisher, we can afford to take a few more chances on projects, and perhaps, you know, that's what we're known for in the market, that other co-edition publishers in other countries look at the sorts of books that we are producing and have on the list, and because they know they're going to see something different here to what they might find on a very large publishers list that, you know, in the big corporations, you find people much more subject to the pressure of marketing and sales and, you know, the bottom line. I mean, that's certainly the case. So in terms of the risks I've taken, I think in my previous job, in 2006, it was a period when climate change and concern about the environment was at a particular height, and I felt very strongly we should publish a kind of eco list, and so I did commission a number of books, and it was at the time it was quite a push to get it through sales and marketing because those sorts of books didn't have a great track record of sales. It wasn't possible to, you know, point to bestsellers and say, look, if you do a book on this kind of subject, you're bound to sell, you know, 20,000 copies. So I was pleased to take the risk. I'm afraid, you know, I can't say they were bestsellers, but I'm proud of the books that came out, and I think they were important, and I'm glad to have, you know, gone out on a limb and got them through.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Sandra. Really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. And I know we've got a few people on the line who may have some questions for you. If anybody on the line is on mute, do remember to press star and zero to unmute your telephone. And would anyone like to come in just briefly, tell us your name and if you've got a question for Sandra?
Yes, this is Angela. Good evening, Sandra. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
One question was burning for me was that I'm not a genre writer. I don't see myself writing the same kind of book for the rest of my life.
Mm.
And I just wonder, is it possible to have a relationship with maybe a small publisher where, you know, I'll be writing a fiction spiritual book, and then after that it will be maybe a romantic fiction, but in a completely different concept of what a romance would be, and then maybe a non-fiction spiritual book?
Yes, I think it is possible. It's not easy because, you know, I can hear the salespeople talking.
Screaming already.
Already saying, no, but this is how we, you know, present the author with this particular identity to booksellers and publicists will say the same thing. That's how we present the author to, you know, the media. So it makes their job harder, that is what they would say. So, you know, I think that for that reason, you know, authors do take on pseudonyms because it just does help. And I can completely understand why as a writer you don't want to be straitjacketed, but if you look at the other side of the equation, what is the best way to make sure that your book and you get out there and are, you know, heard amongst all the noise of the other books coming out, you can see why if you have a clear identity as a writer in this kind of subject, it makes it easier.
Yeah. I think for me the subject area will be the same. Just the format delivery will be different, that's all.
Well, I think that's a really interesting area, and I do feel with spirituality that, you know, an area that, you know, I think is really ripe for exploration is spiritual fiction or fiction that explores spiritual themes, because there aren't too many examples of really successful titles in that area, but there have been titles that just have kind of caught people's imagination and just you know, inspired people. And I'm certainly aware of some non-fiction writers who in this field who are writing fiction now, and I think going to be really interesting to see if they can sort of make that leap, because I think it's another means to explore some really important ideas, and I do, you know, obviously I love fiction, and I think it's a great different way to kind of explore some of those really important and interesting themes.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Anybody else on the line wants to ask a question of Sandra?
Sandra, hello. It's Anne Hodson.
Hello.
It's been so interesting listening to all of this. I came in a little bit late. I don't know if anyone else asked you anything around this idea, but what would you tell us some of the spiritual novels? I mean, do you think that Dan Brown is a spiritual novelist? It's just kind of an amorphous category for me.
It is. It's, I mean, you know, I think I agree it's a difficult category to sort of pin down. I mean, I think he's interesting, and I suppose Kate Moss, you know, who wrote Labyrinth, is they're writers who've taken subjects that we've certainly, you know, published a lot of non-fiction books on. So we've published a book on the Cathars, and we've published a book on Freemasonry and the Knights Templar and so on. And so the subject area is certainly one that interests people. I guess books like The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho are in another category, perhaps, where he's written something of a fable in a way that says the reading process itself is perhaps a kind of spiritual journey. And I think, you know, Dan Brown and probably Kate Moss are much more interested in the plot, obviously, and the book drives along with the plot and covers interesting sort of esoteric subjects, but isn't necessarily perhaps focused on a spiritual kind of outcome, whereas The Alchemist, you know, very much has that spiritual message at the core. So, you know, I'm really interested in seeing manuscripts in this area, and I think it's pretty woolly. You know, I think it's probably a matter of seeing what can work. But, you know, for us as publishers, if a book has a subject, a matter that, you know, is one of the kind of interesting areas for people, like The Knights Templar, for example, mm-hmm. And explored that and did it in an interesting and kind of evocative and thought-provoking way, then I think we're in a position to consider publishing it, even though we're not fiction publishers at present. But I think we're very much interested in exploring new areas, and I think that could be a really fruitful one.
Mm. It's Victoria. Hey, Victoria.
Hello.
I wanted to sort of carry on from that into this sort of question about creativity and originality and first-time authors. I mean, I was looking at your lists, and I see that you've got a new book coming out on chronic fatigue.
Yes.
Which looks a very good book about sort of it's kind of format-wise, it's kind of very sort of orthodox, how do you get over it?
Yes.
And the book that I'm writing is, I have chronic fatigue, but whilst I've been having it, I've also been a lecturer at Cambridge University.
Right.
And I was really interested, the way I've written it is it's partly memoir about how the experience of having chronic fatigue was like under those circumstances.
Mm.
But what really interests me is learning and how difficult it is to change and how difficult it is when we want to do this profound learning that takes us into different areas of ourselves.
Yes.
And so it's a bit of a hybrid, and that's what I'm interested in, is kind of creative nonfiction, where you have sort of, you know, I've got fictionalized elements of my students' dramas, you know, and their struggles with learning, you know, sort of comparing and contrasting with my own struggles with chronic fatigue and trying to learn from life and overcome things. And I don't know. You see, I'm really worried that someone's going to come along and say, no, you know, write the chronic fatigue memoir or write a university novel, but don't try and put them together. But I kind of think they're interesting together. So,
I mean, I think they can be. I think it's always a question of what speaks most powerfully to the reader, and sometimes it is sharing, you know, that direct experience of, you know, what's unique about your own background and the working life you have and the struggles you've had, and it knits in very, very well and makes the point. So I wouldn't, you know, discourage people from exploring that, because of course there are, you know, the other thing we have to bear in mind is there are lots of books out there, you know, books are being published all the time, so everyone's always looking at some way to speak to people in a very powerful, direct way that just, you know, hits the nail on the head. And it's not always obvious what that's going to be. And there are obviously, you know, in chronic fatigue, there are straightforward sort of more health-based model of, you know, what we know about that particular issue and, you know, ways in which it might be addressed. So that sort of book is out there. But equally, it's such a serious problem, and it does affect so many people. And I think, you know, the person who's going through it wants to get answers and wants to relate to their author as well. So I think there's room for a book that has the personal experience and maybe makes the point in an unusual way. So I definitely think it's worth exploring them. I never like to be too prescriptive about the approach people should take. You know, I think as a writer, you need to explore it yourself with some chapters, see how it's flowing. And, you know, often you find a book just does flow because it's all making perfect sense, or it grinds to a halt because perhaps the idea just hasn't gelled and, you know, isn't working.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's very helpful.
My pleasure.
Thank you. anyone else have a
question? Yes, I want to try and come in. It's Denise. I hope you hear me okay. I have a bad throat at the moment.
Oh,
I'm so excited about the novels in the mind, body, spirit area, and thought everything I was doing in my own novel of the Icon Painter's Angel was leading into that genre, mm-hmm. as all my characters get healed and they come to emotional resolutions, which is all set up in the beginning. And I also have the spiritual theme that people pray with icons, and they have a lot of power in some areas and in some countries and so on. And, you know, all the threads were everything I've always wanted to do, and I just wondered, you know, how you gauge the tone, whether, you know, how you know if you're succeeding in your aims.
Yes. I think it is a difficult area because, as I said, it's not really exactly recognised as a genre. You know, you don't find it as a section in the bookshop. So that's partly our challenge as a publisher. And I think it's going to mean we need a number of titles in this area so that we can say, here's a list of, you know, perhaps 6 to 10 books that work along these lines. And at this stage, I certainly haven't, you know, had 6 to 10 books. So, you know, that's part of the challenge, that it is a kind of new genre. We are, you know, treading a new path, and I think it's going to need more proposals coming in, and I'm obviously very keen to see them, because I want to get a range of particular approaches. And then, you know, again, from the publisher's point of view, internally I need to pitch this to our sales and marketing and say, okay, there are certain kinds of books out there that I think fit the spiritual fiction genre. We, as a publisher, should move into this because we already publish in the non-fiction area, and here is a list that I've got. So, you know, I think your proposal definitely has a lot of the elements, and I've been kind of sitting on it in a typical publisher kind of way, but my excuse is I haven't had other proposals yet that I really want to get in to sort of have a sense of what this genre could look like and what sorts of things we can make as a promise, mm-hmm. you know, because it's all about a kind of marketing pitch in the end of, here's a new list for us, and this is what these kinds of books would offer the reader. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think your proposal was really interesting, and as I said, I'm certainly very interested to get some more in and see where we might be able to take it.
Okay. Do you think it doesn't have a healing element, but with something like The Mists of Avalon, could you see that on your list?
Yeah, I mean, I think so.
A version of that. We know that's been out and published and so on.
Yeah, I think it could be really interesting because, you know, fiction is actually still really strong as a genre in the whole publishing climate. Fiction is still doing really well, and I think people are fascinated by mythology, by the Celts, by you know, mysteries from the past. It's just such a fertile area, and fiction allows you to explore things in very different ways. So I have great hopes for it, and as I say, I'm waiting for some more proposals that are due in from other authors. So I'm hoping, you know, it probably won't be this year, but perhaps next year we can start to gather together a list that's looking very appealing, and that we can pitch in a particular way to the marketing people.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting because The Mists of Avalon had extended my experience. I had such a powerful experience in the garden, in the Chalice Garden, that someone then told me this has been written about. This is, you know, it is a spiritual place, and I noticed the mists. I was saying, oh, look at these myths. I was getting up every night, look at the myths.
Yes.
Have you read the myths of Avalon?
I haven't, actually. Yes.
I don't know, but someone said that to me.
Oh, I see.
I was already, you know, half into my novel, and they said, have you read the myths of Avalon? Oh, no, don't tell me. Someone's been there already. And now I'm steeped in the novel, and it's one of those novels I actually don't want to pick up because I don't want it to end.
Yes. I mean, that's anyway. It's wonderful, and I really agree. I think it could be a really exciting area to publish in, so
anyway,
I hope we'll be able to do that.
Yes.
Thank you, Sandra. Maybe just one last question from me, actually, in that respect. I was wondering, you talked earlier about the idea that sometimes you actually come up with a concept or an idea and you commission writers to do that. Do you think the spiritual area is an area, a spiritual fiction area is an area where you might do that in terms of thinking, actually, I'd like to commission a spiritual fiction book about X, or do you think actually that sense of when you come up with the idea, it's going to be best to do that in the area where you've got more, I suppose, of a kind of record of having published those kind of books?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly have approached some of the nonfiction authors I've worked with to just broach the idea with them and see whether it appealed. And people are intrigued. I think if you're a nonfiction writer, the difficulty probably is that nonfiction is a bit more manageable. You know, if you've got commissioned books in that field, you kind of know how long it's going to take. It's a more structured writing job, and so for that reason, this particular area is probably just a bit harder for people to start developing stories in. But so I certainly have approached people. I didn't really want to put ideas in their heads. I thought it would be interesting to see what people came up with. But I think, as I haven't actually had too much coming in, it may be time to kind of suggest some subject areas and just see if that starts to intrigue people. I think in fiction, and especially in this area, you know, I did hesitate to sort of suggest what people should write, because I feel it's, you know, it's got to sort of be very personal and a sort of subject area that, you know, matters to the person. But I think, yes, it's got to the stage where I might need to just prod people a little bit.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to hearing how those prods turn out. what comes of them.
Yes.
bizarre note. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a really fascinating conversation, and you know, I know that everybody here and those people who download this afterwards to listen to will get an awful lot from this. So thank you for giving your time.
My pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. It's been great.
Me too. And I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Indeed. Thank you
very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Very
bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Hello.